And welcome to Off the Shelf, Festival of Words. In this Ideas Alive episode, Dr. Madeline Callahan from the School of English explores the Romantic poets and their obsession with death and the afterlife.
Death is the ultimate mystery. We all know that we will die. We will all lose people. But we know nothing concrete about what comes afterwards. The Romantic poets, that so-called tragic generation, were obsessed by death and the afterlife. And for good reason. Keats died at only 25, Shelley at 29, and Byron didn't make it to 40. Even though Wordsworth managed to live until 80 years old, he was the exception, not the rule. And he lived his young life without his mother, who died when he was 8 years old, and his father, who died when Wordsworth was just a teenager. The Romantics were intimately acquainted with loss. So what did they have to say about death and the afterlife? What can we learn from them? Poetry was the space where each of the Romantics worked out their complicated feelings about death. Wordsworth got the ball rolling. His Lucy poems are poems of profound grief. Wordsworth writes about his shattered feelings as he comes to terms with Lucy's death. Now, we don't know who Lucy is, or if she ever even existed. It seems like that's not the point. Wordsworth makes these elegies read like poems to deal with the suffering of the living, not poems to commemorate the dead. It's all about us, those of us left behind when someone we love dies. Let's look at She Dwelt Among the Untrodden Ways, one of the most famous of the Lucy poems.
She dwelt among the untrodden ways, beside the springs of Dove. A maid whom there were none to praise, and very few to love. A violet by a mossy stone, half hidden from the eye, fair as a star when only one is shining in the sky. She lived unknown, and few could know when Lucy ceased to be. But she is in her grave, and oh, the difference to me.
Lucy lived without the notice of most people. Never praised and loved by very few, Wordsworth doesn't prize Lucy for being the most dazzling person or the most beloved, but she was, for him, the centre of his life. Rather than us having to acknowledge Lucy as objectively important to the world, we are made to see the power she has to change Wordsworth completely because of her absence. We feel the gap where she should be, as we can never quite fix our gaze upon this dead woman who stays half hidden from the eye. We linger on the poet's feelings, not Lucy. Wordsworth does something so important here. He focuses upon the mourner, the person who has lost their love. He doesn't try to avoid the implications of death. It's not just the person who dies that is gone. The mourner now is a different person, transformed through loss into someone who'll never be quite the same again. Wordsworth's final line here, "the difference to me," breaks through the poem to beg us to realise the gravity of grief. Why does he do this? I think he wants to connect with us, to make us see the unbelievable change that grief wreaks upon the living. When we lose somebody who we love, we don't have to act like we're the same. We can, with Wordsworth, admit that we are not what we were, and that pain transfigures us and turns us into somebody completely new. In the Lucy poems, Wordsworth doesn't even try to imagine an afterlife. He doesn't talk about heaven or faith or hope for Lucy to return to him. She is in her grave, and she may never even have existed in real life. But for John Keats, the spectre of death was all too real and not an imaginative exercise. for Keats knew that he was dying before he was even 25 years old, and he had no real faith in the afterlife. His exploration of the life after death comes because he knows death is coming soon. He did not welcome it. His poem, This Living Hand, wasn't intended for publication, and it aims to shock. The intricacy and the threat of this lyric throws down the gauntlet to the reader. The poem is a matter of life or death.
This living hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping, would, if it were cold and in the icy silence of the tomb, so haunt thy days and chill thy dreaming nights, that thou would wish thine own heart dry of blood, so in my veins red life might stream again, and thou be conscience calmed. See, here it is. I hold it towards you.
Plunging us into the poem, Keats insists on the specifics of this. It is this living hand, his own, that the reader must envisage. Not only does the hand live, but this hand is capable of earnest grasping, with earnest forcing us to recognise a personality, a self that holds out its hand to the reader. The conditional, if it were cold, affectingly because obliquely, snaps us into a recognition of the speaker's mortality and into reflecting upon Keats's own failing health. Instead of garnering our casual pity, Keats turns threatening. The reader will be haunted and long for death to return the poet's lost life to him. This isn't fair. But the poem doesn't care for this. Keats cannot be freed from his mortality, and we cannot be freed from the poem's insistent demand upon us. We readers react to the knowledge of Keats's death and to the threat of our own deaths. For in Keats's philosophy, mortal life is the only life. In a letter to a friend, Keats wrote,
I wish for death every day and night to deliver me from these pains. And then I wish death away, for death would destroy even those pains which are better than nothing. Land and sea, weakness and decline are great separators, but death is the greatest divorcer forever.
When we think about this quotation in the light of this living hand, we feel the agony, the passion, and the power of poetry. Even more, we see poetry's powerlessness, for our blood cannot bring Keats back. Our compassion and empathy does no more than keep his name, not his body, alive. For Keats, being human is all we know, and finally, all we have. Percy Bysshe Shelley didn't react well to Keats's death. Though they weren't the best of friends, they knew each other. Shelley thought Keats was a great poet, and even offered to put Keats up in his own home in Italy to help Keats to recover from the illness that finally killed him. Keats never made it. Sadly, in their own day, not too many people agreed with Shelley that Keats was a gifted artist. Neither Keats nor Shelley was popular during their lifetime, and Keats's early death meant, as far as Shelley knew, that Keats would never have the chance to win success. So Shelley decided to write his own elegy to commemorate Keats, which he called Adonais. Unlike Wordsworth in the Lucy poems, who didn't feel the need to insist on Lucy's real-world importance, Shelley sought to praise Keats, to denounce all the critics who'd mocked him, to insist on Keats's talent. But Shelley also wanted to think about his own tumultuous life, his personal struggle with the critics, and the death of his adored child William, who died while he was only a toddler in Rome, just as Keats died in Rome. Shelley made it all come together in Adonais. For Adonais is an elegy, and elegies are fundamentally poems that deal with the death of a person or people, and they promise us two things. The first is that the poet can express their grief, and the second, that through this expression, that the elegist will find consolation and transcendence. Basically, the elegy is meant to heal its poet. Shelley was not convinced. And he went as far as to question the value of life itself. Through Shelley's intellectual contortions, eternity, access through death, might stand for liberation rather than nothingness or pain.
Peace, peace, he is not dead, he doth not sleep. He hath awakened from the dream of life. 'Tis we who lost in stormy visions keep with phantoms an unprofitable strife, and in mad trance strike with our spirit's knife. Invulnerable nothings, we decay like corpses in a charnel. Fear and grief convulse us and consume us day by day, and cold hopes swarm like worms within our living clay.
But Shelley's proclamations, though spirited, remain tortured, where what he describes of life amounts to a deliberately one-sided onslaught against the horrors of mortality. Speaking an eerily compelling soliloquy, Shelley forces his reader to observe the abject physicality of living, where the repulsion from daily pain climaxes in how cold hopes swarm like worms within our living clay. You can hear the disgust as Shelley makes us feel the grossness of being alive, forcing us to see how we live as terrifyingly random. We live in a mad trance, and the living are the ones decaying every day while we age, because of the suffering that we undergo. But Shelley wields his rhyme with such precision as to prevent the poem accepting this philosophical formula. Shelley makes grief seem to stand alone in the stanza, as it's unable to sound with life and knife, escaping from the enchainment of rhyme. We are not allowed to just accept the view that Shelley would seem to push upon us. Shelley whispers, rather than shouts, that death may not be the cure for all wrongs, and life may not be only fear and grief. Shelley has not explored any kind of afterlife. Instead, he seems to reject life, even though he has nowhere else to go. The final lines of Adonais make it even clearer. Shelley cannot come to terms with life, but death remains terrifying. Imagining himself forced out of the world and into the atmosphere, Shelley's journey beyond the mortal sphere does not feel joyful. He writes,
I am born darkly, fearfully, afar, whilst burning through the inmost veil of heaven, the soul of Adonais like a star beacons from the abode where the eternal are.
There is a grim sense of Shelley's prophetic rhetoric forcing him along against his will. Having left himself with no choices, he is borne along without it being his decision as to where he goes or if he goes. Keats, as Adonais, beacons towards Shelley, but we're no closer to seeing Shelley deal with death. And it's because Shelley won't pretend. He won't pretend to know for certain what comes after we die. So all we get is an imagined place where the eternal are. I wonder, are we supposed to see all of us as eternal? Or is it just a chosen few? That alone makes Shelley flinch. There's no guarantee for him, and there's no guarantee for us. A different problem rears its head when considering the work of female romantic poets, especially Letitia Elizabeth Landon. The distinct privilege enjoyed by male writers was the luxury, the power, and the time to meditate upon questions of the afterlife, rather than having to attend to the issues of this world. Landon, or Eliel as she was known in her day, was a phenomenon. Landon is rarely remembered, and when she is, it's often with the nickname the female Byron, and the emphasis is upon the word female. Despite Landon and her peer, Felicia Hemans, outselling so many of the male romantics, even people like Wordsworth and Keats, those household names, most people haven't heard of their work nowadays. And this really is our loss. But it would have been a tragedy for her. Because what Landon wanted most of all was for her work, the best of her in her own eyes, to survive. She brings context into her poetry, letting us see and feel the pressure upon women, upon the female poet, and the unfairness of being kept out of the literary pantheon. Landon writes herself, often with more hope than certainty, into the future. She can accept bodily death, but she could not accept the idea of her work dying with her. Landon, in typically self-aware fashion, shapes the afterlife as a site of wish fulfillment rather than philosophical probing. For when the spotlight turns onto her writing ambitions, Landon offers a fascinating meditation on her poetic afterlife in Lines of Life.
Why write I this? Because my heart, towards the future springs, that future where it loves to soar on more than eagle wings. The present, it is but a speck in that eternal time in which my lost hopes find a home, my spirit knows its clime. Oh, not myself, for what am I, the worthless and the weak, whose every thought of self should raise a blush to burn my cheek? My song hath touched my lips with fire and made my heart a shrine. For what, although alloyed, debased, in itself divine? I am myself but a vile link amid life's weary chain. But I have spoken hallowed words. Oh, do not say in vain.
Women were supposed to be modest about their achievements. And we see Landon being humble here. But you can't miss the glint of ambition in the lines. Self-deprecation isn't only camouflage for ambition. It was a learned response to how female poets were treated. They were judged as lesser artists and almost confined to their own category by contemporary critics like Frances Jeffrey. Landon directly appeals to the future, to the life after death, as she yearns for her work to survive her. She longs for her plea to posterity to be heard and to be one day considered the equal of her male contemporaries. Landon was already reckoning with the tricky concept of poetic afterlife that was in direct opposition to the limits of the society in which she lived. It's not that Landon wants to transcend femininity, but instead she wants to show us what she's up against. Take her choice of form. Its determined regularity suggests unadorned honesty and a communal ballad feel. The poet, Landon claims, looks to the future, and the present here is a mere speck. The poet's spirit finds its home in the ether. Divorcing self from song, Landon claims to be a mere weak creature who never considers herself, but it is song, those hallowed words, which elevate her. But even this flush of confidence in her poetry is endangered. Although she longs to believe, there is no simple sense that divine song will guarantee an immortality for her poetry. Landon draws upon the Bible to make her song seem literally holy. She goes on to imagine her work read by people of all genders, and it seems that she believes that her poetry, and even her existence, is justified by the response of her readers. The desire for her poetry to find the reception it needs to be justified is so remarkably vulnerable, and Landon's speaker seems poised between yearning and fear. She hopes that there will be a world one day where her work will be read for its own sake and not mocked or neglected because she is a woman. The afterlife Landon longs for is through her poetry, as she looks ahead to a time when her gender won't define how she's treated by the establishment. Her physical death might be worth it if her poetic work gets to survive in a kinder age. Immanuel Kant held that there were two questions that couldn't be answered by pure reason, but these questions remained ultimately compelling. Is there a God? And is there immortal life? For all Kant's philosophical toolkit, eternity, considered as the site of any possible afterlife, remained an article of faith and not a deduction from reason. So poetry steps in. Schlegel tells us that where philosophy stops, poetry has to begin. Poetry is the ultimate way to imagine what is beyond the mortal world and what death means to us. And in this imaginative effort, each poet discovers the distinctiveness that proves their worth and the worth of poetry. Grief and fear are part of how these poets respond to death, but so is defiance, excitement, and power. The afterlife vacillates between being a concrete reality, a seductive fiction, and a terrifying blank. We read poetry to see our own faces reflected in poetry's mirror, and maybe even to see something better. How can we die like a romantic poet? We might do that by knowing that we do not know, by trying to hope despite our pain, and by facing up to the thrill, the uncertainty, and the agony of the life after death.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the festival, please visit www.offtheshelf.org.uk. We'd love to hear your thoughts and responses on social media. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.